He said he loved watching me with other men, said it turned him on. But what started as a fantasy became surveillance. Control, a system of power disguised as pleasure. I thought I was free, until I found the server room, until I saw the tapes, until I realized I was never the wife. I was the subject. This isn't erotica. This is a crime scene, and the camera was always rolling. This is my confession. This is the final freak-off. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. They say the camera never lies. But that's bullshit. Cameras lie all the time, not through what they show, but through what they don't. The angle. The lighting. The edit. What you see in frame, and what's deliberately kept out. In this house, the truth was always out of frame. My name's Eliza. I live in a quiet neighborhood just outside Atlanta. You know the type, identical two-story homes, white vinyl fences, garage doors that buzz open like obedient mouths. Out front, we look like every other couple. My husband Jordan even waves to the neighbors when he waters the lawn. But inside it's a studio, a stage, a surveillance lab, and I'm the show. The first time I slept with another man while my husband watched, I thought I was in control. I told myself I had power, that the thrill was mine. Jordan made it sound like a gift. You can do anything, baby, as long as I get to see it, as long as I'm part of it. He used words like empowerment and freedom like a politician, masking a prison with poetry. I said yes because I was bored, not with him exactly, with us, with routine. I was 32, married for 7 years, and every Friday night felt like a rerun. So when Jordan brought it up, watching me with someone else, I laughed at first. Then I agreed. He booked a motel. Not a sleazy one, not yet. Clean walls. No mirrors on the ceiling. Just one hidden camera, perched in a vent facing the bed. Jordan stayed in the next room with a wireless receiver and his headphones. I'll never forget how calm his voice was when he directed me through the door. Tell him to take off your dress slow. The man was a stranger. I never even caught his name. Afterward, Jordan said he'd never been more turned on. He replayed the footage like it was art, slowed it down, isolated frames, studied it like it held celestial insights. He said he could see things in my body language. True body intelligence, he called it. I started to wonder if he was watching me or studying a species. That was 2 years ago. Now, there are 5 cameras in our house. 1 in the bedroom, 1 in the hallway, 2 in the basement, and 1 I only recently found, inside a fake smoke detector above the kitchen table. I asked Jordan why it was there. He smiled and said, "It's part of the architecture now." He doesn't ask anymore if I'm okay with it. He just books the room, picks the man, and gives me a time. I go. I perform. I come home. Then we watch it together like a couple watching a home movie. Except in this one, I'm naked, and he's silent. And the air between us smells like something rotting behind the drywall. The most recent freak-off was in a motel called the Garden Inn. Irony, right? There's nothing blooming there but mildew. I had just finished with some stockbroker type, all cologne and no charisma, when Jordan texted. Good performance. You didn't fake the moan this time. Felt more authentic. I'll cut a final edit tonight. I stared at the screen and felt nothing. Not shame. Not pride. Just emptiness. Like being praised for blinking correctly. That night, I showered for almost an hour. Steam crawled up the walls like fog in a horror movie. Jordan sat on the couch watching footage, adjusting color, slicing angles, syncing audio. Like an editor in a backroom server room, curating the perfect illusion of pleasure. He told me once, "This isn't about sex, Eliza. It's about understanding human dynamics. Behavior. Real emotion." He believes that. I think he really does. But me? I'm starting to forget what real emotion feels like. And then came Cameron. But I'll tell you about him later. For now, just know this. The most dangerous thing in a toxic relationship isn't the violence. It's the performance. Because the moment you stop performing, the moment you break character, someone always breaks you. I used to say yes because I wanted to. Now I say yes because it's easier than explaining why I want to say no. That's the trick with psychological manipulation. It doesn't feel like manipulation. Not at first. It feels like choice. Like freedom. Like the opposite of control. You don't see the trap because the bars are made of words like respect, openness, and connection. When Jordan first introduced the idea, it wasn't a demand, it was a seduction. We were sitting on the back porch, late summer heat crawling across my thighs. He handed me a glass of wine, his voice lower than usual, syrupy like he'd rehearsed it. What if we redefined intimacy? What if monogamy's just another script we follow? What if we explored something more honest? He used language like a scalpel, slicing through ethical standards, social norms, even my own hesitation. He didn't need to raise his voice or threaten. Jordan wasn't a monster. He was a marketer, selling me a dream I didn't know I'd pay for in pieces. That first time felt like a choice. By the third time, it felt like a job. And by the seventh, it felt like a film shoot. Jordan never touched the men he chose for me. He wasn't interested in them. He was interested in me with them. The angles, the breath patterns, the sounds. He once paused a video mid-frame to analyze the tension in my lower back. "Right there," he said, zooming in. "That's true body intelligence. You're processing more than arousal. That's cognitive feedback reacting to layered emotional states." I blinked. He was talking about my orgasm like it was part of a research paper. Over time, the sessions became more structured. Jordan built what he called the feedback grid, a system where I'd rate each partner on a scale of 1 to 10 across a dozen metrics: emotional impact, body awareness, scent, aggression, technique, post-play behavior. He was turning sex into data, and I was just a human analytics engine feeding the cloud. I once asked him if any of this made him jealous. His answer chilled me. "Jealousy's for people who fear being replaced. I've designed the system. I am the system." There it was, the mask slipping. This wasn't about love. This was about control. Control through permission. Control through performance. Control through the illusion of freedom. He stopped asking me if I liked the men. He stopped checking in afterward. Eventually, I stopped talking during the car rides home. He'd play audio back from the freak-off while driving, like some twisted soundtrack. One time he asked me if I moaned differently with this one than the last. I didn't answer. I just stared out the window, memorizing the exit signs, imagining pulling the door open mid-turn and tumbling onto the pavement just to feel something real again. Some nights, I tried to reclaim agency. I'd pick outfits that made me feel ugly, refuse to fake it, go completely still. Jordan would notice, not emotionally, but aesthetically. "You're out of sync," he said one night. "It's throwing off the rhythm." I told him I didn't feel comfortable anymore. He blinked once, then said, "That's not discomfort. That's transformation. You're evolving into someone ungoverned by shame." That was the moment I realized what this was. Not exploration. Not consent. It was conditioning. Jordan had been engineering me the way you engineer a product, stripping me of boundaries under the guise of enlightenment, using terms like behavioral psychology, emotional exploration, market dynamics of desire. Words I used to read in books, now weaponized and whispered into my mouth like poison kissed in honey. I remember one night, the man he chose was rougher than usual. He slapped me hard, not playfully, not consensually. Afterward, I showed Jordan the bruise on my thigh. He stared at it like it was a work of art. "It means he pushed you past surface-level response." "That's rare," he said. "There's depth in that. Complex emotions." I stared at him, then at the screen, then at myself, paused mid-frame, eyes closed, jaw clenched, skin blooming violet. That night, I took 2 showers. I didn't cry. I just disassociated. People think manipulation is about yelling, gaslighting, shoving someone into decisions they don't want. But that's not the dangerous kind. The dangerous kind? It's the kind that whispers, "You're free." It's the kind that dresses up coercion as consent. It's the kind that rewards obedience with intimacy and calls it growth. By the time you realize the bars are there, the door's already locked. And the key is in his pocket, watching, always watching. His name was Cameron. He wasn't supposed to matter. Jordan found him through a fetish board, one of those mask message forums where people trade boundaries like currency. Cameron fit the profile: tall, discreet, well-spoken, open to freak-offs, comfortable on camera, and most importantly, clean. He was just supposed to be another one-off, another shadow in the room, another climax for the archive. But Cameron didn't follow the script. And for the first time in 2 years, neither did I. The freak-off was scheduled at a motel just off the I-85, a half-dead place with peeling paint and a neon sign that buzzed like it was giving CPR to its last letter. Room 109. Same setup as always. Wireless camera in the vent, clean sheets that still smelled like bleach and secrets. Jordan sat parked in the back lot with his laptop, connected to the live feed. Cameron arrived exactly on time. He didn't try to seduce me, didn't compliment my body, didn't perform for the lens. He just looked at me, really looked like I wasn't a role or a kink or a story already written. Like I had a face instead of just skin. When we undressed, he didn't ask me what Jordan liked. He asked me what I liked. And when I didn't answer, when I froze out of habit, he said quietly, "You don't have to perform. I'm not here for him." I should have stopped. I should have walked out. But I didn't. Because for the first time in a long time, someone gave me permission to feel human. Afterward, I pulled on my robe, walked into the bathroom, and stared at myself in the mirror. I couldn't remember the last time I looked this undone. Hair wild, cheeks flushed, eyes wide open. I half expected Cameron to be gone when I came out. That's what they all did. A quick nod, a zipper, and a vanishing act. But he was still there. Dressed. Sitting on the edge of the bed. Waiting. "You don't belong in this," he said. "I've seen women like you before. The ones who smile for the camera and cry off screen." That sentence cracked something in me. I told him I was fine. He said, "You're not." And then he left. Just like that. No number. No promise. No theatrics. But later that night, after Jordan had already downloaded the footage and was deep in his editing trance, I got a message from an unknown number. "Next time, coffee. No cameras. If you want real." I didn't reply. Not for 3 days. But I read the message over and over again. It wasn't romantic. It wasn't seductive. It was real. And that's what terrified me most. The second time we met, it was in daylight. A small diner 2 towns over. I wore oversized sunglasses like a cliche and sat with my hands wrapped around a mug I never drank from. Cameron talked about everything but sex. Music. Mountains. Regret. He told me he used to be a therapist. Left the field after a malpractice scandal that wasn't his fault, but still cost him his license. I asked if he missed it. He said, "Sometimes. But helping people only works if they want to be helped. You've forgotten what wanting looks like." I didn't respond, but something inside me cracked further. Not broken, just open. We met again. And again. Always off book. No motel. No camera. No Jordan. The third time, we kissed like we were underwater and the world was watching. His touch didn't ask anything of me. No performance. No choreography. Just presence. I remember thinking, this is what it feels like to be felt. That night, when I came home, Jordan was editing again. He paused a frame and asked, "Why didn't you arch your back this time?" I blinked. "I guess I forgot." He looked at me the way a director looks at a broken prop. "You're slipping," he said. No anger. No panic. Just disappointment. Like I was a scene ruined by poor delivery. That's when I knew. I wasn't his wife anymore. I was content. Archive. Proof of concept. A behavioral experiment with a wedding ring. And if I didn't get out soon, I'd forget how to be real altogether. Cameron offered me an exit. Offshore. New name. New city. No cameras. Just light. But to leave Jordan, I'd have to lie one more time. One more freak-off. One final performance. And pray he didn't see the truth in my eyes. Because Jordan, he never stopped watching. And men like him don't forgive betrayal. They document it. Every addict has a ritual. Jordan's wasn't heroin or alcohol. It was playback. I'd catch him at night, sitting in the dark, glow from the monitor flickering across his face like candlelight in a church. He'd play old freak-off tapes frame by frame, lips parted just enough to let the obsession drip out slow. He didn't touch himself. He took notes. That's how I knew I was no longer a person to him. I was footage. It started with something simple. The router blinking red. I couldn't stream music in the kitchen. I texted Jordan about it. He told me not to touch anything, that the connection was rerouted through the secure line. When I asked what that meant, he gave me a smile that felt like a sealed envelope. So, naturally, I waited until he left for the gym. I followed the Ethernet cords down to the basement. They snaked along the ceiling like veins. One disappeared behind a panel in the far wall, a wall that didn't used to exist. When I pushed it open, I didn't find a storage closet. I found a server room. A dozen hard drives blinked in a soundproof chamber. 2 tower PCs. 3 monitors. 1 red leather chair. The walls were lined with shelves, each labeled with a freak-off date. USBs. SD cards. External drives. All color-coded. All categorized. I wasn't just being watched. I was being archived. And not just in the motel rooms. There was a folder labeled Kitchen Prep / Thursday. Another titled Phone Mirror Scroll Patterns. He'd been recording me outside the bedroom. Outside the agreement. Outside any line we ever drew. I sat in his red chair and clicked open one file. /mirror_feed/bedroom_nov_12.mp4. It was me, sitting on the edge of the bed, crying after one of the sessions. Alone. Silent. Vulnerable. I thought I was safe. That night I cried so hard I bit my own wrist just to muffle it. He'd recorded the whole thing. No angles. No arousal. Just pain. And he saved it. Labeled it. Cataloged it. I scrolled further and saw folders with my name. But not just mine. Cameron.mp4. Eliza+C_01. Crossover_rehearsals. I froze. He knew. He knew about Cameron. Before I said a word. Before we plotted our escape. Before I even understood what I felt. Jordan had it all. He had footage of our coffee dates. He had text logs. He had camera footage from the motel where Cameron and I hid the second time. I don't even remember seeing a camera. He must have planted it before we arrived. And then I found something that made my stomach seize. A folder called /PRE retribution. Inside it, a file labeled last_session_script. It was a document. Outlined. Time-stamped. It listed the final freak-off Jordan had already scheduled. With Cameron. He had written it like a director's shot list. Angles. Dialogue suggestions. Beat-for-beat transitions. Even the lighting plan for the motel room. And at the bottom in bold red text. Performance must end with elimination or dissolution. Whichever comes first. I didn't know what it meant. Not then. But now. Now I hear it every time I close my eyes. I heard Jordan's car pull into the driveway. I backed out. Closed the wall panel. Didn't breathe until I was upstairs, back in the kitchen, pretending to fumble with the Wi-Fi settings. He walked in like nothing was wrong. Kissed me on the cheek. Still not working? He asked. I smiled. Nodded. Then whispered back. It will be soon. I told Cameron we had to move faster. That Jordan knew everything. He didn't panic, just asked one question. Does he know we're leaving? I paused. Then lied. No. But the truth? The truth was already backed up on 3 drives, uploaded to 3 separate cloud folders, and synced to Jordan's private network. Our exit wasn't just being anticipated. It was being directed. And the final scene? Was coming. If you've never plotted an escape from a man who knows your passwords, your gait, your facial tics, and your orgasm cadence, let me tell you, it's not easy. It's like trying to slip past a mirror without casting a reflection. Everything felt like surveillance. The toaster. My perfume bottle. The radio in the bathroom. I started seeing red lights where there were none. Hearing the soft hum of fans where there were only shadows. Jordan had built an ecosystem of control. But control is delicate. And I was done performing. Cameron and I met at a storage unit 40 minutes outside the city. His idea. No Wi-Fi. No cameras. No glass. Just corrugated steel and secrets. He brought burner phones. A second set of IDs. Cash. Maps of border towns. A list of offshore account setups from a guy he used to work with in Panama. Back when he still wore a tie and helped rich people move guilt across oceans. Jordan thought he was the mastermind, but Cameron knew how to disappear. I just needed to get out alive. The plan was simple. One last freak-off. Jordan would want a finale. We'd give him one, scripted, sexy, seamless. Enough to keep him glued to his laptop. While he reviewed the footage, I'd ghost. Cameron would loop back in 30 minutes with a car parked near a gas station off Route 8. From there, out of state, then out of country. We had a window, 7 hours tops, before Jordan would realize the footage was a farewell letter, not a submission. But planning it felt like war. What dress wouldn't raise suspicion? What lines could I say on camera that would sound like passion but feel like goodbye? I memorized my own body language. Practiced fake eye contact in the mirror. Trained my tone to sound like lust even when it carried grief. Jordan noticed. He always noticed. You're more focused lately, he said over dinner. You've leveled up emotionally. There's less noise in your movements. I smiled and played dumb. I guess I've learned what you like. He reached across the table and touched my cheek. No, baby. You're learning what you are. I held his stare and lied again. And what am I? His eyes lit up like a man watching a lab rat finally solve the maze. Ready. That night, he sent me a voice memo. The next session will be with Cameron again. I sense unresolved energy. We'll schedule it for Friday. 10 p.m. room 205 Crescent Motel. You'll wear the red lace, the one from the rooftop set. Audio should be crisp. I've adjusted the room mics. That memo hit harder than a gunshot. Jordan had planned it before I knew how to escape. He wasn't guessing. He was orchestrating. I told Cameron. He went silent for 10 whole seconds, then said, "We give him the scene, and then we disappear." In the days leading up to Friday, I barely slept. Every noise was a wire, every flickering light a lens. I wiped every device, scanned for spyware, hid my burner phone inside the lining of a tampon box. Jordan started working late, or so he said. I imagined him in the server room, scripting, editing the finale of a movie we hadn't filmed yet. The final performance, Eliza Unleashed. I wondered how he imagined it ending. Did he think I'd come crawling back? Did he think I'd break down and thank him for unlocking some primal version of myself? Or did he know, deep down, that this performance would end with him alone in the audience? Friday came like a funeral. I packed a small bag, 2 shirts, 1 toothbrush, 1 photo of my mother, put it under the floorboard in the garage where Jordan never checked. I kissed him like it was just another night. I looked into the mirror one last time, and I whispered, "This is the last time I fake it." At 9:42 p.m., I stepped into room 205, red lace, lipstick bleeding like a wound, Cameron already inside, body stiff, eyes soft. No script between us, just survival. We both knew what this was. A dance for the monster behind the lens. A goodbye disguised as porn. I mounted the bed and pulled Cameron in. I moaned for the camera, but cried with my eyes. He kissed my shoulder and whispered just loud enough for the mic, "Don't look at the lens. Look at me." And so I did. Even when the lights buzzed. Even when the mic crackled. Even when the camera blinked, red, watching, recording. The performance ended at 10:41. Cameron left first. I lingered, pretended to freshen up, slipped the burner phone into the lining of my bra. I looked once at the camera above the mirror, and I said, "That's your last tape." Then I walked out the door, and into the night. The car ride after the session was silent. Cameron gripped the wheel like the road might betray him. I sat with my hands between my thighs, heart thudding like a second engine. We didn't speak. There was nothing left to say. We didn't need words. We had escaped. At least, that's what I told myself. We pulled into the gravel lot behind an abandoned gas station off Route 8. The plan was to switch vehicles. Cameron had a second car stashed behind a shuttered mechanic shop. No plates, no GPS, no trail. From there, we'd cross into Tennessee, then head south. Georgia would disappear behind us like a memory we didn't want to unpack. He handed me a burner phone. No apps. Just one number programmed in his. We burned the clothes we wore in the freak-off, his shirt, my red lace. Ashes lifted into the air like tiny ghosts. But just before we left, I asked him, "Do you think he knows?" Cameron didn't turn his head. If he knew, he'd already be here. I wish he hadn't said that. Because the moment we walked into that motel 2 towns away, our safe zone, our temporary nowhere, the television was already on. Muted, but not empty. Playing on loop. Us. That night's session. Edited already. Perfectly cut. With one major difference. Jordan's voice was narrating. See how her eyes betray her. How her hips pause before engagement. That's not seduction. That's hesitation. That's betrayal mid-bloom. He'd dubbed over the entire session, like a psychoanalytic documentary. Each kiss we shared was broken down like a crime scene. Each glance was marked with timestamps and behavioral notes. Jordan's narration was calm, deliberate, detached. Cameron froze. I stepped backward and pressed my spine against the wall. The TV cut to black. A new file loaded. Post-session retribution. The first frame? Cameron's face. Sleeping. From the passenger seat of his own car. Timestamped 10 minutes after we left the motel. Which meant, he'd already been watching us leave. The screen flickered. Jordan's voice returned. Freedom is a myth. Consent is a dance. But betrayal is truth unmuted. Cameron lunged toward the TV to shut it off. But then the room phone rang. Once. Twice. 3 times. He picked it up. His jaw clenched. Eyes went wide. "He said he's coming," Cameron whispered. "He said, don't run. You've already performed the ending." We didn't sleep. We locked the door, bolted the windows, pulled the dresser in front of the entrance. I sat on the edge of the bed, staring at my own reflection in the turned-off screen. And for the first time, I wondered, what if the performance never ends? What if Jordan wasn't just documenting us? What if he was writing a script we were still acting out? At 4:17 a.m., the lights cut out. Not just in the room, the whole block. Silence. Not even the hum of the fridge. Just black. Then, a knock. Not loud. Not rushed. Just deliberate. 3 slow taps. Like a metronome. Or a cue. Cameron pulled me behind him, reached for the drawer. No gun, just a Bible and a dried-out pen. The door creaked open. No footsteps. No breathing. But on the bed, a flash drive. Still warm. Labeled. Final edit. Cameron picked it up with shaking fingers. Plugged it into the laptop. It loaded instantly. The footage. Cameron. Dead. Me. Screaming. Blood. Everywhere. It was footage that hadn't happened, yet, but was cut like it already had. Angles from inside this room. Shots of me frozen in horror. Shots of Cameron slumped forward. Edited. Scored. Narrated. Jordan's voice. The finale isn't real until the actors believe the illusion. That's when I knew. We hadn't escaped. We had entered the final freak-off. And this time, Jordan didn't want to watch. He wanted to end it. With blood. And tape. It was still dark when the screaming started. But it wasn't from us. It was from the hallway, room 207. A woman crying. A man shouting something about God and forgiveness. Then silence. Cameron bolted the door again, even though we both knew bolts were a joke against someone like Jordan. He didn't need to kick it down. He'd already been inside. The proof was in the edit, footage of things that hadn't happened yet. Or maybe they had. That's the thing about a psychopath with a camera. He doesn't follow time. He writes it. The flash drive was still in the laptop. I replayed the final edit 5 times. Not because I wanted to. Because I had to understand. The cuts were masterful. The lighting matched this exact room. The bedspread, the lampshade, the clothes we were wearing. Even the towel Cameron used earlier. It appeared in the shot, bloodstained. It was like Jordan had filmed the future. Or built a set that became our reality. We need to leave. Now, Cameron said, pacing. We'll take the back lot. Ditch the car. Walk until we hit traffic. I don't care if it takes all night. I didn't respond right away. Because something was wrong. I could feel it. Like gravity shifted. Like we were no longer in our own timeline. Like we'd entered Jordan's film. And the script was running out of pages. We packed everything in silence. I tucked the flash drive into my bra. I needed proof. I needed someone to believe me when this ended. If it ended. Cameron cracked the window. He peeked outside. Empty. He opened the door slow, like it might detonate. The hallway was dim. Emergency lights only. I stepped out first. And froze. On the carpet outside the door, arranged like a collage, were Polaroids. Me. Cameron. Jordan. Motel rooms. Freak-offs. Kitchen arguments. My mother's house. Private moments. Sacred ones. Moments that were never filmed. But here they were. Laid out like evidence. Underneath the last one, a close-up of me crying in a bathtub, was a note. Art requires sacrifice. Cameron grabbed my arm. Run. We didn't make it to the stairwell. Because when we turned the corner, he was there. Jordan. Standing. Calm. Holding a camcorder in one hand and a hammer in the other. Wearing all black. No rage. No breathlessness. Just readiness. Like he was clocking in. Final scene, he said, lifting the camcorder. No need for rehearsal. Cameron stepped forward. Put it down, Jordan. No, Jordan replied. I want the moment real. No fakes. No overlays. Just truth. I stepped between them. You don't have to do this. Jordan smiled. I already did. He pointed the camcorder at us. You ran. You tried to erase the narrative. But the body doesn't lie, Eliza. The frame doesn't lie. You love the lens. You loved being known. And then, he hit Cameron. Fast. Hard. Once. No warning. The hammer landed on the side of his head with a sound I'll never forget, like something heavy cracking a watermelon. Cameron dropped. His eyes rolled halfway, caught on the edge of consciousness. I screamed. But the scream didn't come from my throat. It came from somewhere older. Somewhere that remembered what it meant to be prey. I fell to my knees beside him. Blood pooled. Jordan kept filming. Capture the chaos, he whispered to himself. Emotion is only real when recorded. I looked up at him. For the first time in years, I didn't see my husband. I saw a director, high on godhood, obsessed with closure. But not for us. For his film. For his twisted, private masterpiece of manipulation. Please, I said. Don't make me watch this. He lowered the camcorder, just slightly, then said, You already have. This is my confession. Not to a priest. Not to a jury. To you. Whoever you are, wherever you're listening from, this is what survived. This is the version Jordan couldn't edit. The raw cut. The final truth. Cameron died in room 214. Not instantly. He bled for 7 minutes. I counted them in my head while Jordan filmed me screaming, shaking, cradling the man who tried to save me. The man who gave me back my body, my voice, myself. Jordan didn't stop me, didn't touch me. He just walked in slow circles, narrating out loud like a documentary voiceover. See the collapse of agency, the crumbling of autonomy. This is where the subject returns to her original state, nothingness. I didn't hear it, not all of it. I was too busy dying in pieces. At some point, I blacked out. When I woke up, Cameron was cold. Jordan was gone. And the camera? Still rolling. I could have ended it then. Pulled the curtain. Made the blood count for something. Instead, I did what I hadn't done in 2 years. I walked out. No phone. No bag. No plan. Just the flash drive clutched in my fist, and the weight of everything I should have said sooner pressing into my spine like a second skeleton. The flash drive made it to a friend of Cameron's, a woman who used to work in media intelligence. She handed it off to the police anonymously. That's why you're hearing this. Because Jordan didn't just record sex. He recorded crimes, coercion, surveillance, death, and me. I was a character in his story. A theme he bent. A body he branded. I don't know where he is now. Some say he fled the country. Some say he's hiding in plain sight, directing content under a different name, creating immersive experiences for clients who love the thrill of the ethically gray. Me, I think he's still watching, not through cameras anymore, through people, through systems, through every voice that tells a woman, this is for your empowerment, when it's really about submission. He wasn't just my husband, he was a mirror held up to society's kink for control. This is the last tape. I don't care if it's played in court or buried under 1,000 clicks. I just want it said. I wasn't weak. I wasn't complicit. I was conditioned. And now, I'm awake. And if you're listening to this, so are you.